You would please give a welcome to Dr. Eric Herman.
I am delighted to be with you all today. What a wonderful Reformation service it was already. I'm ready to go home. But actually, a nice assembly of people and music and talks today, and I'm very glad to be here. This has been quite a year, 500 years. I talked to one of my neighbors, and he's not a Lutheran, but we were talking, and I said, well, I'm kind of busy this year. I'm traveling quite a bit because it's the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. And he said, oh, has it been that long already? As if it just flies by, right? But no, it's been a special year. Historians have been in demand, so we've been milking it. No one's going to care about us next year, so this has been a lot of fun, and I'm delighted to be with you all. So what I hope to do today is talk a little bit about the time and the world of the Reformation, which is 500 years ago. And in some ways, the Reformation, as we experience it, and as was said so eloquently in the sermon and the hymns that we sing, is as clear and as near to us today as it was to the early Reformers 500 years ago. And it's primarily because the purity of the gospel continues to be preached, and that's really what the Reformation is about. On the other hand, 500 years is a long time, and I think sometimes we forget the great distance that is between us and what Luther and many of these other pastors and theologians were trying to do. And in some sense, paying attention to that gives us a chance to be even more grateful for what we've been given and received 500 years from now. Now, Luther, of course, this is 500 years from this event, which I'll talk about a little bit more today in this lecture as well as in the lecture that follows. But there we have Luther nailing the 95 Theses to the door, which is a relatively simple act. It's not a very unusual act. And he does this in a small German town. But this event forever changes Christianity and the Western world. 500 years ago, Europe was charged like an atmosphere with electrical tensions before the storm, and then came Martin Luther, and the lightning struck, and fire fell. But it's an awful long time ago. When I think of trying to imagine what time is 500 years ago, at the very least, wrong direction here. At the very least, see now my slow animations, we'll just have to wait for it. At the very least, it seems like it's black and white for us, like those old photos. And of course, they didn't have photos. These are paintings. And the furthest I traveled this year to lecture on the Reformation was to Brazil, down in the southernmost part of Brazil. And that took me just less than 14 hours. Luther, the furthest he ever traveled, was to Rome. And that took over a month. So the world has become much smaller. And of course, technology is so much different. I guess we do about 6,000 tweets a second as a culture, 40,000 Google searches a second, and 2 million emails that we don't answer every second. But of course, the difference between our world and Luther's world is much more than technology. It's vastly different in its social makeup, its political landscape, its intellectual climate. The religious world is likewise distant from ours. Its thought and theology are based upon assumptions about God and grace and merit and communion and community that seems very strange to us today. So, I'm going to highlight not everything that's different or strange or unique or important about the world of Luther vis-a-vis our own, but I'm going to highlight three or four of the most important. I'm hitting the wrong button constantly here. Let's do it this way. It seemed like a good idea at the time to make it all slow. And so the world of Luther. Luther's world, first, was a world full of devils. What do I mean by that? I mean that the people of Luther's world were not much different than 1,000 years before. But they're extremely different than the way we think about our world. From the time of the apostles and Saint Augustine all the way through the time of Luther, they felt the physical world as if it were full of malevolent demons as intensely as we feel the presence of myriads of bacteria. And in such a context, Christian sacraments and relics could be treated as much as a vaccine for physical protection as it was for nourishment of one's spiritual life. It was a world where old pagan views persisted in popular piety right alongside Christian practices and views. Those cycles and rhythms of agriculture and the seasons and all of the rites and rituals that came from the pagan practices, if you remember, about 1,000 years before Luther, or about 800 years before Luther, you start seeing these development of these Germanic barbarian immigrations. And they bring with their religious traditions and practices, and even after they're Christianized, those stay. It was a world of magic and superstition. It was one that could hijack the holiest of Christian words, hoc est corpus meum, which is the Latin in the words of institution, this is my body. They could hijack these holy words and transform them, hocus pocus, into incantations and hexes. And that's actually a lovely example where you have something that's very dear and important and central to the church that is transformed into a magical incantation, a pagan magical idea taking hold of words from the Holy Liturgy. In any event, the intellectual, the psychological climate of the people was characterized by a profound unfamiliarity with the basics of Christianity and by a certain pagan mentality with the occasional vestiges of Christian ceremonial practices. Even relatively orthodox Christian priests might delve into alchemy or dabble with astrology, and this would happen well into the 17th century. We know even reformers like Philip Melanchthon, or a generation later, Martin Chemnitz, would do astrology. Melanchthon, because he thought it actually was good science. Martin Chemnitz, I think, to pay for school, would do it. But either way, they thought it was sort of a legitimate way of thinking about the world. The medieval church certainly went through great lengths to suppress many of the abuses, though sometimes it seemed better more pastoral to just adapt Christian ceremony into rites and practices. And of course, we see this all the time where you have old pagan rituals that have been Christianized. Perfect example is Christmas on December 25th, the perfect day to celebrate the birth of the unconquerable God of the Sun, but then gets transferred to be the celebration day of the birth of the S-O-N, the Son of God. And other things. We see this in Yule celebrations that get connected to Christmas. You see this in Easter, which, of course, the resurrection of our Lord is obviously going to be celebrated with little bunnies and Easter eggs and, well, no. But all those practices are still kind of with us. But this is a long journey for the church who tries its best to Christianize the Germanic Europeans. And it was such a long journey that at times segments of the church could forget where they're actually going. Rather than curb superstition and idolatry, the church seemed to tolerate it and in some cases actually perpetuate it. At least that was the growing feeling among Christians in the late Middle Ages, especially the Christians that were getting more and more educated in the cities. The peasant was increasingly replaced by people who could read. And the urban context especially called for reforms. So Luther didn't come onto a stage in which everybody was happy, hunky-dory, and then mess everything up by calling for reform. People had been calling for reform for several hundred years. And much of it was dealing with trying to make people more Christian, more educated in their Christianity. Reform these churchly abuses and reform Christian piety. One of the ways in which some Reformation historians have called this period of time, they've called the whole Reformation period as a period of re-Christianization. And that's a big fancy word that we just make up. Christianization was the first attempt to make pagan barbarians who immigrated into Europe Christian. And then, as that kind of took root and then started to get corrupted or forgotten, there is a second surge of efforts from the 13th century to the 16th century that's really can be labeled as re-Christianization. And this includes everybody. This includes the Catholics. This includes the Reformers. But they have very different views of what it means to be Christian, very different views of what needs to be reformed, and that's part of the difference. But if you listen to Luther, he talks this way. He has this excerpt where he's speaking about if we really educated people about what was necessary when going to the Lord's Supper, if people were truly repentant and knew what they were seeking before they came to the Lord's Supper, he says, heavens, if this idea were put across, it would mean that where there's thousands coming now to the sacrament, scarcely hundreds would come. And so we would at last become a group of real Christians, whereas at present we are almost completely pagan and only Christian in name. And Luther and the Reformers had this view that even though everybody around him was baptized the day or the day after they were born, I mean, I don't think Luther ever actually met an atheist. He may not have ever even met a Jewish person. Everyone he knew was baptized into the one holy Christian and apostolic church. And yet there was this sense that most people weren't real Christians. They didn't understand what it meant to be a Christian. They just were, it was like being born in McDonald's and thinking you're a hamburger. I mean, you're just there, but you really don't have a sense of what his true convictions might be, what Jesus has actually done for you, what the path towards salvation is. You just believe what the church believes, and they'll inform you. Repeatedly, Luther makes this point, and then a lot of his reform efforts and of the other reformers are aimed at these sorts of Christian practices that maybe have either been developed by the church in response to pagan practices, or just exhibit superstition rather than something that grows out of the Word of God. Now, the reasons for why reformers considered such practices as sub-Christian and idolatrous can differ in the particulars between Luther and, say, Zwingli and Calvin and others. But most commonly, it's due to a rekindled reading and priority given to the scriptures and to the early fathers of Christianity. And when they did that, when they read the scriptures afresh, and they read the scriptures with new companions, these early church fathers in which new editions of their writings became to the fore, they realized there's this huge discontinuity, huge gap between what the scripture and the early fathers describe about Christian and what everyday Christians in the 14th, 15th, and 16th centuries are believe and practice. Part of the reason for this was Renaissance humanism, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, but also other movements as well. Observant monasticism. Luther belonged to a special monastic group, the Augustinians, but not just the Augustinian hermits, the observant Augustinians. And part of their goal was to reform the church. They spoke about reforming and educating and catechizing people all the time. And Luther was part of that order and in many ways contributed and extended that goal of reform from his own vantage point. Another way to talk about this period, and I'll talk about this in a little bit, and it's another made-up word, is religionization. And that is, that grows out of the idea that to be religious in the Middle Ages is a very specific definition. Today we say things like, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. I hope none of you say that, but you hear people say that. And that usually means I believe in God or some higher power, but I don't go to organize, I don't go to church. But in the Middle Ages, to be religious meant something very specific. It meant that you had taken monastic vows, that you had taken the vow of celibacy, of poverty, and of obedience. And if you were religious, and when you talked about being religious, that was clear. And if you wanted to be more religious, but you didn't want to take those vows, you tended to imitate that standard of religion that was exhibited by the monastic life. So another way to look at the Reformation is a broadening of the definition of what it means to be truly religious that didn't narrowly focus on just monastics, but upon all Christians. Let me pause there just for a moment. Questions or comments just on this first bit about this re-Christianization. And I'm going to pause after each one of these segments just to give you a chance to respond if you have any questions or comments. As a teacher, I wait for people to get uncomfortable. And no, that's fine. That's good. Okay. If you think of something, that's fine. So the next section, the world of Luther. Luther's world was actually the end of the world. At least that's how it seemed to everybody living in the 16th century. There was Islam, which was making an enormous reach toward engulfing all of Europe in the Ottoman Caliphate. The plague appeared somewhere in Europe every year. There was the Great Plague that came through several centuries earlier, but it never fully left, and every year the plague appeared somewhere, and it was unpredictable, but of course it was deadly. It appeared in Wittenberg and in Saxony a couple of times in Luther's life, and he watched people die and spouses of people die right in that small town. And also, the church had experienced a papal schism. And we often don't talk about this, but this is actually a really important part of the context of the Reformation. Just a couple hundred years before, there was an enormous schism. There were two popes, both claiming to be pope, both excommunicating the other one. And you had all the kingdoms and princes in Europe aligned themselves with one or the other. So all of Europe was excommunicated by somebody. And this is a crisis of authority. And so they tried to kind of think through how do we solve this. And a theory called conciliarism, that is, if we bring all the bishops together in a church council, we have the authority to fix this problem. And this is the highest authority of the church, not just the pope, but actually all the bishops together. And so they called a church council and they said, we're going to depose you two and elect a third. And so the other one said, no. And so we had three popes for a little while. But then eventually, at the Council of Constance, all of this was resolved. And that was about 100 years before the Reformation, in which the schism was finally ended. There was a single pope. But the world was still shook by this. The uncertainty about the authority of the church still hung in the air for people. And the church and empire were dangerously close to dissolution. Now, a phrase that's often used to describe this experience of the end of the world, or what one thinks might be the end of the world, is called apocalypticism. And we think of the apocalypse of St. John or the book of Revelation. Apocalypse just means to reveal or unveil that which was hidden. And the apocalypticism of this age was all throughout, but it's especially exhibited in what we often call the more radical elements of the Reformation. For instance, the Anabaptists. The most famous, perhaps, was the Anabaptist takeover of the city of Munster And this is just a small town in northwest Germany, a walled city. And without getting into too much detail or getting into the weeds of this, essentially, expectations of the imminent second coming of Christ were high among many of the Anabaptist groups. And eventually, they influenced the Lutheran pastor that was in Munster and won over the city in 1534. What does it mean that they won over the city? Well, they declared it, first of all, the New Jerusalem. They drove out the bishop. All property was confiscated and now declared to be held in common. Rebaptism for all people was mandatory. Preparations were then made for the return of Christ and the start of the millennial kingdom. The head actually called himself the new King David, and he proclaimed that polygamy was back in practice. And it kind of sounds like the Waco, Texas, but and it sort of ends that way too. The expelled bishop eventually laid siege to the city with his military and his army, along with the leaders in the immediate area. And the leaders of this movement were tortured, and they were executed and hung in baskets from the church tower of St. Lambert's. You can see there up where I put the red circle, those baskets where they hung the leaders of this rebellion. Incidentally, the baskets are still hanging from the church tower to this day in the city of Munster. You can see them there on the right. Munster is actually a very, very nice city to visit. It's very safe, very little crime for some reason. I'm not sure what the deterrent is. But of course, the most significant event in the Reformation that indicated or caused a stir and a thought that the world might be coming to the end of the last days was the Peasants' War. It began in 1524 with peasants in Stühlingen revolting against their countess. And now, the life of the peasants wasn't actually terribly bad. It was improving, let's put it that way. They weren't serfs like in old feudal times. But the countess in Stühlingen actually, the story is that she asked the peasants in the land that she owned to gather snail shells underneath the strawberry plants and take out the snails and clean them so she could have the snail shells as spools to wind her thread. Well, at this point, the peasants, who felt like there was a little bit more upward mobility going on, were humiliated by it, were angered by it, and it became sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. It ended up not being about that at all. This rebellion spread from southwest Germany toward the north and east until a whole third of Germany was in uproar. They would destroy churches and landlords' homes. They would destroy monasteries. They would kill priests, ruin statues and stained glass. And their message was a bit, it wasn't clear. It was clearly chaos. There was some who tried to capitalize on Luther's message of reform. What was the message in the sermon today from the Freedom of the Christian? A Christian is a free lord of all, subject to none. That's great. Let's go out and be a free lord, subject to none. There's that second thesis that was so beautifully emphasized today that people conveniently forgot and saw that the Reformation was about just general social freedom, anarchy, and chaos. One of Luther's former disciples, Thomas Münzer, was one of the leaders of this revolt. He was an adherent of Luther's cause, but then he came with this sort of Old Testament zeal. He considered himself a prophet, and his theology was animated by the imminent end of the world. He said, "Oh, how ripe the rotten apples are. Oh, how rotten the elect have become. The time of harvest has come, and that is why God himself has hired me for his harvest." Yet, and just as a spoiler, I suppose, the peasants were finally overthrown. Thomas Münzer declared when the princes were lining up over on the hillside that he would catch the cannonballs in his sleeves. And then he saw a rainbow over, and he declared, look, God is with us, his promise, a sign of his promise that he'll be with us. Of course, the princes also saw the rainbow and interpreted it a little differently. And it was just a mass slaughter by the end. They found Thomas Munzer hiding under a bed, and they executed him after they tortured him. 100,000 peasants were slaughtered in that battle. But for Luther, the social uprising was not just some class warfare. Luther always saw more than just emperors and princes, peasants, and popes. He saw their actions as well as his own against this backdrop of salvation history, which, as St. Paul declares, is not our striving against flesh and blood, but against powers and principalities, against the present forces of darkness. Indeed, what could be more apocalyptic than such an upheaval of the world and its order? And we just sang one of the most apocalyptic hymns ever written, A Mighty Fortress, in which the world is clearly coming into an end. It's filled with devils. And the only thing we can hang on to is the word of Christ, who is our conqueror. But for Luther, the thing that really shook him to the core when it came to expectations of the last day was not even the peasants' war. Go backwards. But it was actually his view of the papacy. And this is going to seem a little, harsh or strange to us. We tend not to... it's really going slow. We know our differences between the Roman Catholic Church, but you look at somebody like John Paul II or Benedict or Francis, and you say, you know, they're pretty nice guys. You tend not to lead with, I am the Pope. The Pope is the Antichrist, right? But we know that Luther called him the Antichrist, and this was actually not new. People called the Pope the Antichrist throughout the Middle Ages, especially when they had that schism. They really liked to call each other the Antichrist. But it was often a rhetorical slur. Maybe it was a statement of true conviction that this particular person who had taken the office of the papacy was wicked, and he was the Antichrist. But Luther meant something different by it. Already in 1518, when he met with Cardinal Cajetan, and Cardinal Cajetan was the papal legate sent to Germany to deal with Luther. And if you're a papal legate, it means he is the Pope. He represents the Pope for Luther, to Luther, in that moment and situation. And it's in this meeting that Luther begins to consider the possibility. Cajetan demanded that Luther recant what he believed to be the very gospel. And this troubled him deeply. He said, I would be the most accommodating and beloved person to Cardinal Cajetan if I were to say just the simple word revoco, which is Latin for I recant. But I will not become a heretic by denying the understanding through which I have been made a Christian. He was shocked that the thing that he thought was sort of central to the gospel, justification by faith, and that faith justifies because it holds on to the promises of Christ. This was one of the main debates between Luther and Cajetan, that he was being asked to reject that. He was being asked to reject faith in the promise of Christ. That's how he understood it, this conflict. And it's at that moment he goes home and he writes a letter privately to his friend Wenceslas Link. And he says privately, is it possible that the Pope is the real Antichrist? He doesn't use it rhetorically. He doesn't use it as a slur. He uses it privately because he's fearful. Publicly, he still says some very, very conciliatory things about the Pope. In 1519, he says, Most Blessed Father, I did not, nor I do want to today in any way, assault or pull down with any type of deceit the sovereignty of the Roman Church or that of your holiness. Nothing whatsoever in heaven or on earth is to be placed before it. except Jesus Christ, the one Lord of all. For there is only one thing alone that I seek, that our mother, the Roman Church, might not be polluted with the filth of foreign avarice. So here in 1519, Luther can still speak of the papacy and the Roman Church as something that he's obedient to and that he wants to see succeed. But privately, he's getting more and more nervous. And the turning point came for him in 1520. And I'm going in a little in-depth here because I think it's really almost impossible for us to fully understand the scope of Luther's writings, the urgency of his reform, the power in which he speaks the things that he speaks, if you don't realize how deeply convinced he is that he is in the last days. In 1520, something happened. He was accused in several debates before then that that he was following the teachings of Jan Hus. Jan Hus was a Bohemian who, at the Council of Constance, in which they resolved that schism 100 years earlier, was condemned as a heretic and burned at the stake. And so when they told Luther, the things that you're teaching sound a lot like Jan Hus, Luther says, that's ridiculous. I'm not a heretic. Hus was a heretic. I'm not a Hussite. But finally, he got a hold of Jan Hus's treatise on the church. And he read it, and he wrote this to his friend after reading it. We're all Hussites. I'm a Hussite. Von Staupitz is a Hussite. All of us in Wittenberg are a Hussite. And what's more, St. Augustine's a Hussite, and St. Paul is a Hussite. And then he says this, I am too dumbfounded to even know what to think, seeing such a terrifying judgment of God among men, that the true gospel is considered worthy of being damned, having been torched so blatantly in public for over 100 years that no one can admit it. It is the woe of the world. In other words, 100 years ago, the papacy condemned the gospel as heresy and burned someone who taught the gospel at the stake. And then 4 days later, he wrote again, and he had another document in his hand. And it was this document called the Donation of Constantine. Donation of Constantine was a document that had been around since 800, 900 AD. And it was a supposedly a letter written by the Emperor Constantine from the 4th century. So Constantine, you remember, was the first Roman emperor to convert to Christianity. And there was all sorts of legends and stories about this conversion and about his Christianity that developed. And about 100 years later, there was this story that the Pope at the time had healed Constantine of leprosy. And Constantine, who was so grateful, decided to give Pope Sylvester the entire Western Roman Empire to rule. At least that's what the document said. So, if you remember, Constantine went to the town of Constantinople, which was a really convenient coincidence. He went east and put the seat of the empire in the eastern Constantinople. But the Western Empire, he says, I give to you in perpetuity. And this document was used throughout the Middle Ages to continually bolster up the Pope's own authority over kings and emperors. He was the kingmaker. He was the one who decided who would be the Holy Roman Emperor, because only he could delegate that authority because it was properly his. People had questions whether this was a true document or not. But in the end of the 15th century, a scholar named Lorenzo Valla did a full analysis of the document and proved that it was a forgery because it used Latin that wasn't invented yet in the 4th century. And Luther got a hold of that document within the 4 days that we just talked about. And he says, here I am, I'm holding in my hand proof that it's all been a lie. Good God, I'm so overwhelmingly horrified to the very depths of my being that I can scarcely doubt that the Pope is the very Antichrist, which is commonly known the world has expected, since it all fits how he lives, what he does, what he says, and what he proclaims. And the reason why I'm emphasizing this is because, again, the urgency with which Luther speaks, and sometimes the crassness with which he speaks. At the end of his life, he works with Cranach, and he has these incredible treatises, as one way to talk about it, on the papacy, with lovely cartoons of gross things that you do to the Pope's hat and stuff. And the idea is, look, we're in the last days, and they're going to try to turn you away from the gospel. And so if you're confused, and if they're spinning your head around, if you see a guy with three crowns on his head, no, that's the Antichrist, and run the other way. So he has this sense of urgency, and explains a lot of his extreme statements. On the other hand, he has an incredible sense of patiently doing one's vocation, even if the world were ending the next day. You've heard this, the saying, perhaps, of Luther, that if the world would end tomorrow, I'd still plant an apple tree today. He didn't say that, but it's a great saying, and it's lovely to attribute to Luther. The thing that he did say, though, was in 1525, when the peasants were about to sweep into Saxony, and he thought he was going to die, he said, I think I'll get married. And so he wrote a letter to his friend. He says, the peasants are coming, but I'm still going to get married to my Katie if I can manage it, to spite the devil. But all of those things are really important factors in understanding Luther's world, which is a bit different than ours. On the one hand, we say every day at prayer, come Lord Jesus. But I think we'd be surprised if he did. And Luther clearly wouldn't be. Let me move on to the next area. The world of Luther was a world filled with humanists. Well, not those kind of humanists, but Renaissance humanists. And usually when we see the word humanists, we think of people like Karl Marx and people who don't believe in religion. But in the 15th and 16th century, there were people who were called humanists, or people who promoted humanism. But they were all Christian. It was the study of it was like the humanities, like we talk about, liberal arts. And it was an important time of education, of what they called going back to the sources. Especially in the North, humanists were dedicated to going back to the best writings and scholarship of Christian history, in order to reform the church. So again, before Luther showed up on the scene, there were people who were speaking of reform. Let's see if I get this to go right here. So for instance, Erasmus, he wrote very powerfully about reforming the church, going back to a simple form of Christianity rather than the philosophy of Aristotle and all the crazy theology going on in the university. He says, let's just do the philosophy of Christ. Let's read the Gospels of Christ, follow his example. And in order to do this, he published the first Greek New Testament in 1516. And Luther used that Greek New Testament. As soon as it came off the shelf, he was lecturing on Romans, which we heard today, and he started reading the Greek New Testament to help himself understand it. When he translated the Bible into German, when he was at the Wartburg Castle, he used the Greek New Testament to translate from the Greek to the German of the people there. He did it in 11 weeks, which is crazy. But the importance of Renaissance humanism can't be overestimated. And you have the first picture that you saw there was of Philip Melanchthon, one of Luther's partners, and he was a teacher of Greek at the University of Wittenberg. Luther had encountered various forms of humanism in his own education. But most important, really, was the role that the printing press played. And the printing press, of course, was a new technology in the 15th century. But the people who really ran the printing presses and promoted it and gave subject material for it were, of course, people who could read. People could write. And they were often the most educated people, the humanists who ran the printing press. But the printing press was a technology waiting for a blockbuster. And Luther was that blockbuster. He was the first bestseller when it came to books. And it was the humanists who eagerly ate up those tracts and those books that Luther wrote and tried and stole them before they were ready to be printed, and printed it in their own printing presses, and brought his ideas around his city councils and in princes' courts. Between 1517 and 1520, Luther's publication sold well into 300,000 copies, and this is in a world that's still largely illiterate. In 1519, the humanist printer in Basel said that Luther's treatise, The Address to the Christian Nobility, that we've never seen such sales in any other book. In 1521, his opponent said, no printer will print anything but Lutheran books. Luther's German translation of the New Testament in 1522 sold 5,000 copies in 2 months. And then 50 printings in 4 years, each printing 1,000 copies. And then over 200,000 printings in the course of the next 12 years. The humanists were not only the readers, they were the key catalysts for making Luther famous. Luther was easily, by 1519, 1520, the most read human being in the world at the time. The last thing, we have about 10 minutes left, and I want to move on to the next thing. So this, we know about the printing press and the technology, the spread of Luther's ideas. But I think the most important thing that's often overlooked is that Luther's reform, for him, was animated by pastoral care. And I'll go into more detail about this in the next lecture, but I want to give a little bit of an overview because this is part of the context, too, of Luther's day. One way to look at this problem is I'm going the wrong direction, aren't I? Here we go. Luther's world was too religious. In the sense that I mentioned earlier. So in one sense, it was too religious, and in another sense, it wasn't religious enough. We are celebrating specifically 500 years of the nailing of the 95 Theses. What was the point of the 95 Theses? The point of the 95 Theses is an act of pastoral care, or perhaps another way to look at it, it's a protest against bad pastoral care. And it's from this perspective that one should try to understand what Luther was up to in those early years in the Reformation. As the scholar Jane Stroll once put, one could describe Luther's entire career as a mounting of a lifelong pastoral malpractice suit against the church at every level of the hierarchy. Luther had a lovely line that he said in 1516 in a letter to his colleague about what needed to happen in the church. Latin, pro re theologica et salute fratrum. This is all for theology and for the salvation of the brethren. In other words, Luther didn't see the reform of theology or an academic disputation or the things that he did in the classroom as one thing, and what happened in the pew or in the daily Christian life as another thing. He saw them as all one thing. If we reform theology, it was for the sake of salvation of the brethren. Who are the brethren, though? This is a portrait of Luther in 1520. So Luther is about to be declared a heretic in this picture. But what do you notice about him besides his svelte figure? He's a monk. When does Luther stop being a monk? You want to take a guess? Sure. Either one, whichever one you want to run with. No, that was in 1518, and so here's 1520, and he's still got his head shaved, like in a dashing haircut. So even after that, he still considered himself a monk. Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, right, you know, so you roll over the next morning and there's pigtails on the pillows, you know you're not a monk anymore. And really, that is the end. I mean, just a little bit before he took off his habit and didn't get a new one. It was wearing out and he decided, you know what? But he had worn his monastic habit all the way up until that time. He was part of a religious order. He was Brother Martin. He signed his letters Fratrer Martinus Luder Augustinianus. Brother Martin Luther Augustinian. Until October 31st in 1517, which is the first time he signed his name, Martinus Luther, the phrase we know. And we know that he was starting to play around with his name, because Luther kind of means filth or dirt. But Luther, he tied into this Greek word, Eleutherios, which means free, right? And he would sign his name as the free one. But he still signed himself as the Augustinian, Frater Martinus. So salvation of the brethren, his brothers referring to all Christians, like you see in, say, the New Testament, Paul talks about brothers, be kind to the brethren. Or is it referring the brother, like the monks, his fellow monks? And it's actually the mixing of these two, the confusion, intentional confusion of these two meanings, that's really part of Luther's reform. Just real quickly, pastoral care on the eve of the Reformation consisted of two main areas of things. One was the official churchly ways to care for people's souls, the official priestly way in which to deal with the problem of sin and guilt over sin. And those were really, and I'm sorry, it's a little out of focus here, but it's penance, sacrament of penance and confession, indulgences, and the sacrifice of the Mass. These were the three things that priests did as official things that would deal with sin. This was the core of pastoral care, if you will. And we know that Luther right away takes up all three things and begins to write against them, or write about the proper understanding of them. But there's also other things that are really more from the bottom up, especially among the literate, little devotional treatises on virtues and vices, or a very popular text in the 15th and 16th century was this devotional text called the 14 Consolations, which was based on a vision that some Franconian shepherd have about 14 saints. And if you prayed to each saint had a different ailment that he would either protect you from or cure you. You know, John prayed to him if you have gout, or if you have, you know, intestinal difficulties, you pray to St. Agnes or whoever it is. But they had these. This became a cult and a popular devotional practice that people used to console themselves and to help relieve their own suffering. Ars Moriendi, or the art of dying, or the art of preparing to die, was a very, very popular type of treatise or devotional tract that people would read, preparing themselves for death, which then was probably sooner than later. And then Lives of the Saints literatures, Legends of the Saints, stories about the miracles that the saints in the Middle Ages, they were examples of God's grace, but also objects of devotion. These were extremely popular in Luther's day. And Luther, in a sense, went about, and you look in his early years of reforming, he either writes new versions or reform old versions of each of these things. He's out to change pastoral care. So what is at the heart of this change? For him, it's really the most far-reaching aspect of the Reformation. And that's this subversion of the saint, this redefinition of what it means to be religious, the sacralization of the secular. And Luther did this through a single biblical assertion. He said, religious vows don't make you religious. Ordination doesn't make you religious. Rather, it's baptism and it's faith. Against all of the piety during the day, the common people are actually spiritual. They're actually religious. The common people are priests. All people are to be, all Christians are to be called religious. And as I was saying, you have this monastic life that before was sort of the standard. And so there were these two tiers of Christianity. If you wanted to be religious, you followed the monastic way. If you wanted to just be a Christian who relied upon their piety and the gifts of the church, you just tried to follow the Ten Commandments and go to church as much as you can, and that was sort of it. But the point was, being a Christian wasn't being religious. And when Christians, lay Christians, wanted to be more and more religious, they imitated the monks. They would live together in communities and maybe pray their daily offices. Or maybe married couples would take vows of celibacy to gain a greater spiritual standing. And this practice is what was called the modern devotion or the devotio moderna. And this was happening on the eve of the Reformation more and more. People were longing to deepen their religious life, but the only ideal that was set before them were the monks. And Luther flipped it on his head and said, all of you who have received the word of Christ, who've been baptized, you are religious. And of course, this brings up some pretty important questions. Like how does one read the scriptures and how does one pray if monasticism isn't really the standard of being religious? Luther is sometimes credited with embracing lay life and lay vocation. But I think that's probably not as helpful as understanding it in the reverse. Whereas the monastic person, part of his life was to renounce his worldly goods, renounce his ties to married life, renounce his own freedom by being obedient. Luther was saying that salvation was about the renunciation of everything that you had, even your own righteousness, so that all that you have left is Christ himself. And that means that it's not just the Augustinians and the Franciscans and the Dominicans who are beggars, but we are all beggars, he says. As he notes in the treatise of the Freedom of the Christian in 1520, a Christian lives not in himself, but in Christ and in his neighbor, otherwise he's not a Christian. He lives in Christ through faith, but in his neighbor through love. By faith, he's caught up beyond himself into God. By love, he descends beneath himself into his neighbor. Well, I'm going to stop there. I'll be able to expand a little bit on that in the next lecture. But to kind of summarize this, Luther's what we sometimes overlook is, because we're not aware of the kind of practices that the church was carrying on, how deeply Luther was concerned about that. And he almost programmatically goes through and reforms each and every one of the popular devotional practices. So what? So that the word of Christ might be the central point of piety, the central point of devotion for all Christians. And in doing that, all Christians truly become religious people. Thank you very much for your attention. We might take 1 minute or two to ask a few questions. Otherwise, we do need to move on to another talk. But thank you very much.